Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? Today I'm exploring the joy of joyful madness. My guest today is Dr. Wellington Manario Costa, also known as Welly, both as a scientist and as a recording artist. Welly is this year's global winner of the Dance Your PhD Prize, which is a joyful collaboration of science and the arts. Dance is used to communicate the findings of what can be complex academic research and to reach new audiences. It's a tough but inspired challenge and a joy to see science celebrated through the arts. The visibility of this relationship is especially important when a divisive political approach between the arts and sciences has dominated here in the UK, but it's not a natural division. What is and isn't natural is also a critical finding in Welly's scientific work. His three-year study of wild kangaroos has evidenced the natural diversity of kangaroo personalities and without conflict. He was able to conclude kangaroos are different, just like us. Differences happen in all species. It's just natural. And this is what you see in Welly's video, a group dance that includes a fantastic drag queen with Brazilian funk, classical Indian and ballet dancers all performing to his own song, Kangaroo Time. Welly's own lived experience as a young gay man growing up in a conservative rural area of Brazil alerted him to being different and how the social environment can also shape our behaviour. His life experience changed dramatically in Australia, where he now lives, after he first arrived into Canberra's Multicultural Festival, the largest celebration of diversity in Australia. This iconic three-day festival brings together more than 170 multicultural communities and celebrates diversity through food, art, song, and dance. So let's hop to it, kangaroo style, and talk more about joyful madness to one of the world's leading researchers in kangaroo behaviour and now a recording artist. And you never know, you may unleash your inneroo too. Hello, Welly, and welcome to Can Art Save Us.
Hello, Paula. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so pleased. I've really been itching to talk to you. It was so exciting when I saw you win the prize. So thank you again for joining me and all the way from Australia.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here today. You're one of the first people to message me, actually. It took a little while until you could actually have the conversation, but I'm very pleased to be here today.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic because, of course, things exploded for you. But yes, I love this rich collaboration of arts and science. So I was thrilled I could reach you quickly. So, Welly, how transformative has this been for you in terms of this collaboration of arts and science? Has it really impacted your scientific work?
It has impacted my life in general, and I think it didn't impact the science as a whole as well. That goes beyond to my own research. I've got so many beautiful messages from researchers in the whole world, people thanking me for bringing diversity, for bringing this different take, novelty as well in a way of doing communication. Scientists sometimes think writing an article and being featured in a newspaper, it's enough communication. And when they saw a music video with a music, original music, dances that also normally, traditionally are not seen together, sharing the same stage and all that for the name of science, everybody got so excited. And And I just received the most beautiful messages. I think the whole process of making this video in general, it's to talk about the kangaroo time, which is my time living abroad, living as a gay man in a workspace, as a Latin that is an immigrant to Australia. But it really is a reconnection to myself as well. As a child, I've always been very passionate about creative arts, performances, singing. But as you mentioned in the introduction, I didn't have the opportunity to do much of that as a kid. One, because we come from the countryside and we didn't have access to arts or to dance schools or to singing schools. My family is not musical. And my hometown in general is not musical, and neither scientific, but I got opportunities in my country to do science. I have always been a good student. I feel like school has always been this safe space in that very conservative world I lived. And I got great opportunities in science. And when I was in high school, undergrad, I started doing research, and in undergrad as well, I got the opportunity to leave the country, which was like something I would never dream of because it was beyond the scope of my life. And I learned a second language. I came to Australia, so far away from home, but I was still missing this connection to my creativity with creative writing, songwriting, singing, dancing. So after the end of my PhD, I really knew that it was the time for me to get back into being more creative and feeling more like connecting to this community, artistic community. So I started dancing more, singing more. But all of that was still separate from the science. And then with this one project, the Dance Your PhD project, I could unify all these different communities, either socially, so the queer, the Latin, the international communities, and the Australian communities I've experienced here, but also my interests, so the science, the singing, the dancing, and it really just felt like the biggest achievement. I had finished a PhD, I had been through my graduation, but the feeling of pride I got from the day of shooting that video was beyond any feeling of accomplishment I've ever had in my life, just because it felt right, it felt unique, and it felt completely me.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it really is a huge achievement. And congratulations again, because of course, distilling such complex work, and it was at least a 3-year study, wasn't it, into a dance is pretty challenging. So it's really fascinating to hear, though, the parallels in your own life with this study of these wild kangaroos, because you're someone that embraces diversity, and obviously you've studied the diverse personalities of kangaroos, and also you clearly, like the kangaroos you studied, have skills in adjustment. For the listeners, would you like to expand on that a little, that perhaps was it surprising for you to see that kangaroos had such good skills in adjusting to different groups despite changes in personalities?
Behavior, as a scientist and talking about the field of animal behavior is usually treated as something quite plastic. So it's expected that the behavior will change with the environment, either because it got hotter or colder, or there was more green or less green or grass. And similarly to the environment, and I think observing the education system itself, and education system is about shaping an individual into something that is what the society expects you to behave like, or like how your parents also educate you to have certain behaviors in certain places and to respect those rules. It brings to us scientists this clear idea that, hey, animals will also be able to adjust. I think what was more surprising, and it's a bit more novel, is that actually behavior is consistent, that the personality is there and individuals are different. But I guess what's very interesting about the type of research I did was that I was studying wild animals, one, and two, I was looking at personality, but by looking personality, I found evidence of personality, so consistency. But at the same time, in the same trait, I also found evidence for plasticity, for individuals changing groups. As they move across different groups, they also adjust their behavior. So they basically have personality, but they also adjust. And the baseline is the personality. So everything starts with that intrinsic response, and then they start observing what's happening, getting the cues from the group, and then they adjust. So this interplay between plasticity and personality was the most, I wouldn't say surprising in general, but kind of was surprising. I wasn't really, really expecting it. I thought most of the time I would be measuring personality. But once I had the interviews in different groups, I thought I was going to be measuring plasticity, but I found evidence for both in all the different tests I had, with the difference that when I was testing the whole group, I found more evidence for plasticity. So they in groups prefer to adjust their behavior when they're by themselves. They tend to follow not their personality. And that was really, really interesting. When we're in groups of friends, and we all have friends from different, I have friends from different circles. So I have the scientists, I have the dancers, I have the singers, the musicians, the people from my childhood who's not educated anyhow, my grandparents who don't even know how to read or write. So my behavior, it does change as I change these different groups. So like if I'm in a group with elder individuals or with more female people in the group, or male, or like this gender interplay as well, we tested that for kangaroos as well, and we found that actually they adjust on the personality of each other. So the group response is an average, or what best predicts, I guess, group responses is an average of the personality of everybody, regardless of whether they are older or younger, or if they're more, they're more males or more females, or if I guess more extreme personalities as well. We adjust, and we have leaders, right, in our way of society. And we tend to follow usually one type of behavior. Why the kangaroos, they don't have that. They don't really care as well who they are in the group with. They don't really, it doesn't seem like they have ways to identify the individual and form those social bonds like friendships. They are more interested in socializing as a whole. So it doesn't matter what the individual is there, if it's their if it's their kin or not, or if it's older or younger, if it's more male or female, they can be found in any groups in a place where they live. So I think what's more driving more group composition is the kangaroo's connection to the place where they stay, to the land. So they have these home ranges and this habitat that is very strong, and they stay there. But all the individuals who overlap that place, they are likely to be found together in groups. And they would adjust their behavior to literally any kangaroo if they're in the same group.
Yeah, I really found this fascinating, social plasticity of kangaroo behavior. It just seems highly skilled as a way of avoiding conflict and being able to adjust so well. And it certainly raised the question in my mind whether social plasticity is something that the human population could understand better, and in terms of well-being.
Yeah, I think we do understand it better, but somehow we mess it up. I don't know how, but like biologically speaking, kangaroos, they exist for a longer period of time. And I guess if you think of an evolution of sociality, their sociality is a bit older than ours, meaning when and less complex as well. So ours is extremely complex, but when you get something less complex and then something more complex, whatever is less complex is incorporated in what's more complex. So it's in there, but we have more things going on. It's just that, I guess, we reflect a lot and think a lot about the sociality itself, and we modify it based on culture, and that we'll also be influenced by religion and morality and ideas of morality and all of that. And how you separate as well people into institutions, into social classes. So it just makes it so much more complicated. While the kangaroos, they don't have any of that. They just live in the place where they are, and their only job really is to survive. So their main job is to eat. And if there isn't food, then they have an issue. Or if there is competition, then they have an issue. But in general, if there is someone trying to eat them, they have a big issue. And that's where sociality comes into place. And I feel like even for our society or any other social animal society, sociality or having other kin or individuals from the same species, I guess, not necessarily kin, in the same area, it's beneficial because it's a security, not a social security, but a security to their own lives. So it's quite different how far we've come as a species compared to those kangaroos. But I guess all these complexities we brought into our lives compared to how simple a kangaroo life still is what really defines, I guess, the way we adjust as well to each other.
Yeah, there's such a lot to learn from this because, as you say, the complexities of human life and existence are so deep and multi-layered, and it seems that human groups now either celebrate or resist diversity. That complexity can bring so many, unfortunately, different barriers that can become harmful. But you were witnessing a fluidity between diversity and conformity in your study, and that's what really interested me. That there's an intelligence in that, isn't there? Being able to adjust and to not make either diversity or conformity a conflict.
Yeah, exactly. They just exist in harmony in their space. And again, they are very connected to that place, to that land. And then all the kangaroos will also be connected to the land. And then they're sharing that space, and that's very clear. And they're sharing because they need to share. It's their strategy, like the sociality itself. It's their social security. It's their life security, I guess. It helps their survival. It helps them cope with the stress of being alone in a place where a predator could come and eat you. We are used to have a separate space, and we want our separate space. And we learn since a kid that what dignifies us is our work, because our work will help us to provide for our family, to buy our own house. And again, that's all you separating yourself from all those other people from that land, and I'll translate word land for a suburb, for example, your street, you know. We live in the same street, which is our habitat, but we all live in different boxes, which are our houses. While kangaroos, they just literally share the street. So they would be on the street, if I can make that analogy type of thing. And they're just very respectful for that, because that's how their lives is, and why for us, I guess, in that ancient time, if you think of Aboriginal culture, indigenous native people, for example. They've lived like that for many years. I guess Europeans sometimes would have as well. But we've grown to want to buy things and to call things ours and to separate us from the others into castes and to join ourselves with the others that have a similar social life or similar interests and needs or not. Why kangaroos, they are just concerned about eating the grass and making to the next year, hopefully with a kid.
No, it's really interesting because it's a shared responsibility of the environmental space with one interest that everybody survives. And of course, design and architecture has such a lot to do with human existence. And exactly what you said, you know, buying your one property or your apartment, these actually become conditions of separation and isolation, unfortunately. We do have a pandemic of loneliness. So I do find this study incredibly important to draw on in terms of how we can improve conditions and well-being for ourselves too. I wondered, Welly, if you could explain to the listeners, in view of everything we've said so far, what your role as a dancer was in the video compared to your lovely array of diverse and different dancers. How would you explain to the listeners what was going on and with your role in particular?
Well, in the video, we had different things happening. Some of them were entertainment. Some of them were very linked to some key messages I want to show from the video. I think the main key message and the reason why I had so many diverse dances was because I wanted, as you said, show diversity in kangaroo personalities, so differences in how individuals respond that are due to intrinsic responses. I was, in some parts of the video, a researcher. In some parts of the video, I was also playing a kangaroo in that social dynamics. I think there is, like, halfway through the video, that's a part that I'm like a soloist. I'm transiting or dancing across different groups. So as I move from a group of ballet dancers to a group of samba dancers and then to hip hop, I adjust my steps, and it's in one take as well. So you can have that clear message of me adjusting what is my dance step, but what really represents in the science aspects is my behavior, right? So thinking of the different groups, those groups that behave in a different way, as a transit across those groups, I adjust the behavior. And then just after I communicate that I adjust my behavior, I show that no, everybody actually adjusts their behavior. So you have like those bigger groups adjusting to each other as well, and showing that it's all quite democratic, really. So the main message of the video is to show kangaroos have personalities, and that's why we got dances from different styles. What I really wanted to show was this spectrum, right? So a personality happens in a spectrum. So you have an individual that's less responsible the way to individuals more responsive to something, to a stimuli. And to show that diversity, I thought, oh, Canberra would be my population. So Canberra, the city. And there is population and many dancers inside this population. So who are they? I'll try to get as many dancers, and for that I had to go to different places, to different dance schools, and invite people on top of my actual friends as well, because I have a lot of friends who are dancers of a Latin related style or Brazilian. So I had my friends, but then I had to go beyond and get like contemporary ballet and all of that as well, which was amazing. And then we show as these individuals group together, they also adjust their behavior. So they do have personalities. You can see that very clearly on the way they move. Obviously, someone who twerks moves completely different from someone who does ballet. And the costumes as well are very different. And I think was one of the highlights of the video, seeing all these beautiful costumes as well. So you can track the different personalities really well based on how they dress and how they move. But at some moments you cannot really tell which dance style it is because they're just mixing up and adjusting their steps to each other.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic and clever illustration, obviously, of your findings. Especially clever to make it so simple, which is by no means easy. For listeners, do go and look the video up. You'll certainly find it easily on YouTube. So picking up on this really interesting skill of adjustment and social plasticity, I'm interested in your experiences of adjustment. So when you were growing up in Brazil, you've already said, you know, you've said before in interviews, you come from a very humble family. There were differences in exposure to education. You obviously had a really good education, but I think you mentioned your grandparents didn't, for example. So I'm interested in how easy or difficult was it for you to adjust when you wanted to do something that was different, that was perhaps going against the grain or the traditions of what your family expectations might be? And how were your family able to adjust to you doing something so different?
Yeah, oh, that's such a good question. There are layers and layers of answers. I think going back as a kid, I didn't have a strong voice, right? So my whole journey was trying to find this voice. And once I got it, I tried to go back and reconnect to myself and just to recreate those connections with my actual interests and try to convey what I actually want to say and be what I want to be. And respectfully involve my family as well. But one thing I've learned is that I didn't have to get them adjusting to me. Sometimes it would be just easier if I went to a group where being there would be easier. As you say, it's very conservative. And one of the, rules of being conservative is that you don't think about it as much. It's just how it is. And sometimes you just need to leave that place and go to a place where it's less conservative and then experience the freedom of expressing yourself and the safety of doing so as well, to build up that confidence in your voice so it can come back and respectfully, I say respectfully because I'm talking about family and you don't want to, you want them to be with you, right? You don't want to just to go and say, hey, this is me. You're all wrong. You ruined my life, my childhood, and things like that. There's still a continuation, right, to life and to those relationships. At least I want that to happen. But in certain aspects, it's just easier if I just, you know, don't do everything with them and do my life to the fullest with a group of friends who are like me. But as a kid, it was one of the first things that I remember feeling was just like this oppression, just like I couldn't even breathe. Like in terms of decision making, I couldn't decide what I was going to do because every decision that I would take, like if I'm playing and there's like a doll and I would grab the doll and I was like, oh, that's a girl's thing. And that happened so much. And I was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't decide what I'm going to play with. Or if I were dancing or like singing, maybe I shouldn't decide if I want to dance or sing. Maybe I should just not do anything. And when they tell me to do something, then I'll go and do. Or if I really, really want to be more imaginative, if I want to move, if I want to dance, if I want to play with dolls or something, I'm just going to withdraw myself and try to hide myself while I do that. So I've always done kind of like I always felt that there was this Wally A and Wally B. And I think that was one of the first conversations I had with my psychologist when I started doing therapy. I think I was like 25, that I was exhausted of having Wally A and Wally B. And Wally A would be what I present to people, and Wally B was what I thought I was, and that people didn't know. But once I started talking to people more, I realized that Wally A and Wally B has always been one Wally, but people would never, they would also stop making comments on Wally B, but they wouldn't know that it was there, which was a bit funny. To know that they were actually being accepting in a way. I just wasn't aware that they were.
Yeah, it's a really interesting description, but also a difficult one, in that it sounds like a confusing and fearful time for a child, especially, you know, when you become fearful of decision making, even around things like what toy should I play with. You're becoming very aware of identity associations. Would you agree there was fear involved? And from that point of view, how did you find the courage to become who you are?
Oh gosh, that was a long process. I think if there was fear, there was panic. There was like the worst anxiety that I still live with. I tried to make use of school, and school is a great place because people are usually more shy. It did feel like I was killing half of me, because I'm also performative and I like being public. I like, I don't know, my creative interests, they involve the public a lot, because it's dancing and singing, right? And I did not dance and sing for most of my growing up. I would do just in the shower, because I remember thinking, hey, if I go in front of the classroom, or even like to present present a seminar or something, I would go thinking people would think I was gay. And if they got to me, I was like, hey, can I ask you a question? The first thing that would come to my mind is that they would ask if I were gay. Like sometimes they would just ask something about the topic, but it was extreme anxiety, to the point that I would avoid going to social circles. I would never go out. My friends were all limited to the time I was in classroom or at work in the office. I had like the best friends in, but I wouldn't go out with them. I wouldn't hang out with them. And I would always know that at any time that we're not like, that we didn't have a secure topic that we're talking about. Let's say we're talking about science, you were talking about, I don't know, the music of someone else. It could be that they were talking about relationships or dating. So I think when I was in the closet, I wasn't pretending to be a straight person. I was pretending to be asexual. I wasn't really talking about anything. And then I just saw this idea that I was a nerd, because I saw in the movies or something like that, that there is like this image link. So I was like, oh, you don't know if he's gay or if he's nerd or if he actually has homework. So that was what I buried myself in. And I think, well, there was, and on top of that was also religious, right? So, and I remember like from 15 to 22, 25, I don't know, I used to pray for God for fixing me, or either that or to kill me. And I never thought I was going to make sure it's hard, but like, I never thought I was going to make it to my 20s. And then I made my 20s. So I was like, fuck. What am I going to do now? And then, I was just very lucky that I got a break from my world and from all those things I was living. And no one really knows, like from back home, because I was not telling that to anybody. I was just leaving that in my head, right? And I think the first breakthrough was like, oh, I got a scholarship to come to the other side of the world. And I got here, I was like, what is this? It's like living in a movie. One of the first people I chatted, and there was like, I was 21, 22. And this is actually crazy how far I went from 22 to 25, for example. Like, it was like so much learning. Anyway, I went to a priest. I confessed I was gay for the first time. So the first person I told I was gay was a priest in Australia, in English. I didn't even know English. And he was actually really cool. And he suggested a psychologist. And the psychologist was gay. And I was like, okay, why is this priest doing this? I was like, and then I was like, I shut myself from those two people and from my friends and everybody. And then my scholarship finished. I went to Brazil and I was like panicky. And it was the first time I returned to Brazil from something big, right? And then there was like all these girls with like interests and like, and I was like, oh, this is so cool. But like, I don't know. And then I was just like, so much anxiety. And then I started talking to my best friend from high school, Carol. And this was like 23, I think 23, 24. And when we were 18, she told me she was dating one of our friends and she is lesbian. And I didn't know. We used to be like very close friends. We were born 3 days apart. We did high school together. And I didn't know that we were like going through high school and through the same issues without talking to each other. But when she told me, I didn't have the bravery to tell her. But when I was 24, we've had like lived a very similar life. So we'd done high school together. And then she went to a different university. I stayed at mine. And then I did Science Without Borders. So I left the country and she left the country. And then we had like the very similar background. So we're still like talking a lot. And then I was like, hey, I need to tell you something. I need to be brave. And she was like the first person, and she was like so lovely, and she gave me so much support, always checking on me. And I think the whole realization of that process with Jesus, and I don't consider myself religious or go to church anymore, but I feel like if God answered my praise, he didn't give me what I asked. He gave me the opportunity, which was like leaving Brazil in my hometown and coming to Australia. That's a miracle. You can say that like that, because you don't do that, like coming from where I came from. So once I was reflecting on it, I was like, okay, maybe I've got my miracle. And my miracle is just to show me that I can be free. And in Australia was the first place I've seen gay guys holding hands in the street and people fighting for like gay equality and same-sex marriage. Like there was like outrageous when I got here. I felt outrageous. And I was like, oh wow, is this really happening? It was like so shocking. And then I needed like 3-4 years to process all that. And then when I process it, just I started making these healthier links, I guess, and just realizing that no, there is life beyond these things that was locking myself inside my head, and I can start sharing more, and I should share more, and I think the realization that I was just like is scared. I was just too scared, and that I needed to be brave and needed to stand for myself, and I started doing that then and never stopped. And look at me now.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic, because you have shown immense courage. And isn't it sad when you think there were two children or young people at school that were actually, you know, best friends, really close friends, who were both having to lock away identities, and you know, and you couldn't share that with each other until so much later. It's really raising two important points, I think, throughout all of your work as a scientist and also as a recording artist. And I think that's the themes of acceptance and also freedom. So when we think about the kangaroo study, The wild kangaroo seemed to have a lovely experience around acceptance. It's part of their social plasticity. There doesn't seem to be a conflict around personalities and having to dominate or insist on conformity. It all comes back to adjustment and acceptance. And I'm really interested in how you reached acceptance. I know that you've explained that process, but I also wondered if meditation was a part of that process, because meditation is also a very useful way of understanding acceptance. Is that something that's relevant to you?
Oh, wow. You touched like what saves my life, basically. I started doing...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's such a good question. Yes, 100%. Well, I started doing therapies, but I never felt like they were long enough. and they were also expensive. And then after my PhD, my PhD was a very difficult journey. And I didn't feel like, as a scientist as well, again, I wasn't feeling like I did fit right in. Like, I love my department, I love everybody, and I respect everybody, but we are very different people. When I came out, I became more performative and more spontaneous, and I started talking and feeling the need to talk more. But again, there wasn't much of that space at work or all of that. And like writing my thesis, writing in second language was that. And I was living like I was doing a PhD and coming out and exploring my creative side and talking to my family and, you know, all that at the same time. And coming from what I just told you, like this whole journey of like hating myself to starting realizing that I should be brave, but I wasn't feeling like I was brave, right? And it was incredibly difficult for my mental health. So at the last year of my PhD, I broke. I shut down and like for 2 months, I took a medical leave and I was just like laying on my bed and looking at the roof and thinking, how am I going to get out? Like, how am I going to get up? So I was really, really broke. And I was, this is going to sound weird, but I'm in a way thankful for COVID. I know that how horrible it was for the world, how many people died, and I don't want to take out of it. But like 1 month before COVID hit, I was at my worst and I was in bed and I didn't have energy to anything. And then the whole web and everything was like going at the normal speed, right, in the world. And then suddenly the whole world shuts and the whole world goes slow, kind of to the same pace my brain could process. Having the COVID at the end of my PhD was very beneficial, actually, because then people start listening more and you would work from home. So you didn't need to go to the office. And then I managed to finish my thesis and I submitted and I moved to the beach because I really needed a space. And what I really needed was to find a way to start feeling happiness again. I couldn't feel happiness at that time. And then I started talking to people and someone recommended me meditation, a meditation called Vipassana, which is basically like to purify your mind. So it's just like silence meditation. You go there and you just sit and meditate for 10 days and you don't need to cook. There's food provided and it's all based on donation. And I was like also broke. I didn't have any money. So I couldn't do any therapy. I couldn't pay a psychologist. I couldn't do nothing. But there was this one meditation that was free. And you just go there and respect the rules, sit down and meditate. And that was my first contact to meditation. And it changed my whole life. And I continued doing it. And I've done maybe 5 courses now. And that just like, I feel like I was just able to go back and do research for another year because I got another contract to be able to do performance, go in front of the audience. And it was just because I've kind of like managed to master my mind a little bit more, and I was not being that very reactive person that I have been. So it helped me to set myself back and put myself together. And as you said, it helped me to build up that confidence and self-love, I guess. I guess from the realization that things change and life is this craziness. It's just impermanent and that's all right. And that's what we are as well as individuals and organisms. At the end of the day, we're just energy, right? But it's kind of like, it's a process. I myself have been through so much, and I think having the opportunity to sit down and do the 10 days in silence, no external influences. I'm just with me. I'm my island. I'm not even thinking or trying to process anything. I'm literally observing what's happening in my body at that right moment. That's the only challenge, the only thing you need to do. That really helped me to learn what it is being present and let things go.
Yeah, I mean, this is really critical, isn't it, to our mental health. And we're not all maybe as aware as we could be that we can take care of our minds in the same way we do our bodies. You know, we can take ourselves off to the gym for our physical health, but there's so much we can do for our mental health. And space is really important, isn't it? Silence and space for reflection is really important. And would you say it's through that practice that you could almost train your mind to become more responsive rather than reactive? Did it help you move away from panic and anxiety?
So much. The anxiety keeps coming back because it's how my brain is structured still. I guess with more practice in the meditation, it becomes easier and easier and easier. I do still live in the world that is crazy. It's just a lot of things happening, and I don't feel like I've stepped my feet into that one ground where I want to stay. I'm still transitioning like big things. Before I was transitioning countries, and then now it's kind of transitioning careers, and trying to establish myself more in the music business. But there's still a lot to do because, as I said, I didn't perform much as a kid, right? So there's still a lot to build, which is exciting, obviously. But that's why I'm doing it, because it's exciting. But it's still a lot of change, right? And once I reach that space where I'm a bit more stable, and hopefully in the next 2 years I will, then the practice also, it will help with the practice. But 100%, I would not have been able to do half of the things I did in the last year if it wasn't because of the meditation and that effort as well in working on my mental health. I think mind is the first thing. If you're anxious about your future, if you're not feeling like you can do things, sit down, meditate, you need that thought to go away. Because if that thought goes away, you can do anything.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an important example for people to hear and hopefully help people that may not have thought about that practice for themselves even. And it's equally interesting, Welly, that of course we're talking about the importance of space and silence as part of the meditative space and practice. And of course, creativity, expression, music, singing, dancing is equally healthy, albeit a noisier space. And so if we move to your choice of actually focusing on your music career, your artistry as a singer-songwriter, again, has that been a courageous shift to make a decision about science or singing? And how helpful has it been in terms of continuing to improve your sense of self-expression and identity?
Oh, wow. Another great question. It is difficult. Like, I feel like when I won the NCL PhD, which is like a competition for scientists and scientists only, and it's meant to stay inside the realms of science as well. And it's literally like a science communication competition. But what I wanted from that as an artist was that it would go beyond science. I would use that competition to transform my science into my music career. And that's why I worked so hard in the music and networking and making a video that would cause an impact as well beyond the scientific community. I feel like, but at the end of the day, winning the NCL PhD was the highest point of the mountain called academic career. That's when everybody knew Dr. Welly from like all the universities in the world. Everybody knew what I studied. People would read my thesis and my papers, meaning it would be the best opportunity to get the best postdoc in probably one of the best labs in the world. And what did I tell everybody? What did I tell everybody at that level? Oh, I'm quitting academia. Please don't contact me for jobs.
Yeah, despite my huge success, it's over.
Don't message me about papers. And those people are not people who could give me some help in their music career. So it's kind of like, it was very brave. I think it was the bravest thing I've ever done. My sister and I were talking about that. I was like, I can't believe you're brave about it. And you did it. And I'm very proud of you. And I was like, thank you. I did it. Now I need to make the other side work. So now I'm trying to spread those news to the music people and see if anyone wants help. So far, I got one chat with one music agency, and hopefully you're going to produce another version of Kangaroo Time. Maybe a slightly different name. But I do think the clubs need a track called Kangaroo Something in this country called Australia.
Yeah. Oh, that would be great. But it's interesting because this does come back to courage. And of course, the roots of courage are in vulnerability. So all the examples you've given us today, right from a child, you know, fears around identity and decision making and so on, those roots in fear and vulnerability ultimately cultivate courage, because once you finally make decisions to, for example, be who you are or leave Brazil to move to Australia or to do something that's completely different to your family, is all about cultivating courage. And of course, you've also found tools to support that. So, for example, meditation. And then having the freedom to flourish as a creative artist. So the EP that's currently out, there's four tracks, and I understand the EP chronicles that transition that you've just been talking about, that departure from academia to a music career. And I know the listeners can find your channel and all of these videos and songs on YouTube, which are signposts on your episode page. Would you like to give us an overview of those four tracks and how it chronicles that transition? I did notice there's that recurring sentence, "Are you feeling all right?" And I wondered if you'd like to expand on that.
Oh, I got goosebumps. Yes, thank you. I'd love to share about this chronicles. It's MIP is really a letter. I think to myself first, and then to anyone else who is facing the need for a change in their lives, regardless of being a career change or relationship change, or even at the end of the day, it comes to the bottom line of if there is something your three-year-old self wanted to do when you're in your 30s or older and you still haven't done it, and you see your day-to-day life taking you into a completely different direction, and then soon you're going to be 50, 60, and you never do that, but it's now the moment, and if you're like, oh, maybe I should do it now, then do it now. I think that's what the main message of the EP is. This EP starts with Kangaroo Time, and the track number one is also the track I used for the Dance Your PhD competition. In purpose, because that's a big celebration. I feel like the best part of transitioning is that you get the time to process as well all those experiences you've had in this thing you're transitioning from and leaving behind, because you learned so much and it got to a point that you either learned everything about it or whatever, the day-to-day life in that doesn't match more who you are as an individual anymore. And I feel like that's what happened to me after my PhD, was the routine of a scientist. It wasn't very clear for me before I started the PhD, but it was very clear after I finished the PhD, after going through the whole process. It's really about repetition and really about testing and retesting the same question. And it's obvious for me now, why? It's because science is about natural world, and it's about finding the truth in the facts, and it's limited by reality, and that's how it's supposed to be, right? But the repetition itself didn't work well with, let's say, my personality or how my brain experiences happiness and excitement. I do need things to be finished quicker, and I need to move on to the next thing quicker. And I find that in music, like writing a song is a big process, and recording and having it ready to be released is a big process as well. But it happens that it's more collaborative. It's easier for you to do that with other people. One, because people who do music, they appreciate that maybe more than the scientist itself that locks themselves in the computer and they just try to do that whole project by themselves and expect everybody to do it like that. And also it's like, it's a big process, but it's also how many words are in the song compared to how many words are in the paper. So you can just get to the bottom of it quicker. So first song is this big celebration of that time. And then the second song is called Shall We Let It Go. It's the actual name tells what it is. It's just like going personal into answering that question that is recurring across the tracks. Are you feeling all right? In the first track, I have it, you surrounded by mates. Are you feeling all right? It's just a play, and all right is kind of like to rhyme with all the verses that came before it. There are verses describing kangaroo fight in a queer way. And then I use you surrounded by mates, and use the word mates because we're in Australia. And means you're in the group, right? Surrounded by mates. And then are you feeling all right? Is that, it's just that taking that take to myself, that, well, are you feeling all right? You're here, you're in this group, you're a scientist, you're in this department, you're doing field work, but are you really feeling all right? And it was a time I was actually not feeling all right. So the second track, the first track, it finishes, this is Welly, are you feeling all right? And then the second track starts with Welly, are you feeling all right? And the answer for that is, it stopped feeling calm, shall we let it go? And then it's really a track that it could be used for like breakups. I would call it like a break free anthem. and I just go more personal and say, hey, I got to this point that it's not about being right or wrong. I'm actually not feeling calm. I'm not feeling satisfied with the situation that is in here. I should just let it go. And kind of like having that as a conversation. And then it moves to track number three. It's basically an interlude where it touched base into the transition, actually, the need for transitioning between academia into a new reality. as a reflection. There isn't, it's not structured as a song. There's a little bit of singing there, but it's really a weird, reflective track that leads us to the last track in the album. And that's a very interesting track. It's in reggaeton. It's singing in Spanish. It was the first time I sang in Spanish ever in my life. And that song has nothing to do with anything back. And that track is what I call the new reality itself. It's a very imaginative, story that contrasts and it's imaginative for a reason, because I wanted it to contrast a lot with the empiricism of science. So it's basically leaving this ground of research and being pure and in touch with their reality and moving to something that could be anything, like very imaginative, very creative. And the story plays with the word doctor. And it takes me back to my hometown where my mom would tell her friends, hey, my son is a doctor. And they think I'm a medical doctor because they don't know what a PhD is. Yeah. And the story itself is just a girl in Australia who loves the reggaeton. It's 2 a.m. She's been dancing since 10 a.m. Since 10 p.m. And the party goes until 7 a.m. in the morning. But she's like tired. Her body's tired because she's been dancing for like 4 hours already. But she's got to go. I need to do until 7 a.m. And she hears about this kangaroo doctor, Welly, who is a kangaroo doctor. And she's like, oh, maybe he can make a surgery. And if I have feet and tail of kangaroos, I would have that energy. I would be able to make it to 7 a.m. But when she finds Welly, he's not that kind of doctor.
Yeah.
It's just very imaginative.
It's lovely. So it's a really lovely story that you've put together, you know, that's chronicling obviously your life, your transition. And what really stood out to me in that was the significance of letting go, because of course that is part of acceptance. It goes back to acceptance, whether it's accepting ourselves, who we are, that process we might go through when we feel different to everyone else. There's that personal acceptance, and letting go is so important when we have to try and let go maybe of the negative things we just repeatedly tell ourselves automatically, habitually. And also letting go sometimes of past negative experiences. And I think what's important about that is it's not in any way a passive resignation, is it? It's quite an active process, learning to accept, as is meditation. Would you agree with that? That part of our well-being, and if we undertake meditation, it's a surprisingly active process. It's not kind of being in a trance-like state and, you know, half being asleep. It's a very awake state.
Mm-hmm. In my meditation, they call when you're meditating, they call it working because it's a lot of work. And your work is one task, right? It's to be present. It's to observe your body and your sensations as they are in that moment. And it's incredible when we start doing that and what our brains do, because our brains is so trained to do the opposite, which is basically to get one sensation and start breaking it down into deeper thoughts. And then this thought brings in the other thought and then brings that emotion, that heavy emotion of something that's related to something that doesn't exist anymore. It's all gone. But we somehow are trained to bring back those memories and, like, in such a situations, be triggered by some things. And being triggered basically means you saw something or you sensed something that's linked to a negative experience in the past, and then just feel exactly what you felt when you're in that negative experience, or even worse, or like panic attacks and all of that. But it also extends, like, when you think of like not being able to control your mind, sometimes it's for things you actually crave. And I never realized that, like, the effect a trauma has in your life is similar to the effect of something you want so bad as your head. because if whatever you crave is not there, you're also going to suffer, right? If something you are aversion to is there, you feel bad. If something that you want is not there, you also feel bad. So you're just that product of reactions and reactions and reactions, and you just feel very miserable all the time. And I feel like the meditation itself helps you, or it doesn't help you unless you do it correctly. And that's what's difficult about meditation. That's why it's called work as well, because you gotta be able to fight this tendency of your brain taking you into these different spaces and try to stay with the air you're breathing right now, and with how it feels, if it feels warm, if it's tingly or numb, or whatever sensations actually there in this moment, and then being able to continue observing that, because not because you sensed it now it's going to be there forever. So what's the next one? So just this curiosity of what's actually going to be the next sensation when the time comes for it to show up, and that's a lot of effort. It's a lot of work. It's so hard because we're not trained. But the more we do it, the more it's easy for us to let things go, as you're saying, and just free ourselves from these patterns of the mind, just old patterns of the mind of reacting in a way that will actually just make us suffer, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And curiosity is such an important quality to highlight as well, that we can really benefit from being curious about how our own minds and our own thinking is working. So you've touched on so many important points. And you said something really beautiful, I thought. Well, you've said lots of beautiful things, but something that really stood out to me was when you were talking about adjustment in terms of your family and yourself. So when I asked you about how your family adjusted to you, for example, when you wanted to be that person that went off and did something different, and you really emphasized that you weren't interested in rejection, you really respect your family, and it was always about acceptance of who they are, and it is equally about acceptance of who you are. And I thought that was such an important description, that it goes back to exactly what your study has done. It's the acceptance of difference and the acceptance of diversity.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's beautiful. Thanks for saying that back.
So, as always, this hour flies by. It always flies by for me because I'm hearing such interesting things. So I ought to move to the end question, which is the series question. And how would you respond to the question, Weili? Can art save us?
I think art is saving us every day. Art is a creative world, and by creating I mean we use our brains, our senses, our abilities to take something from the reality we're living and go somewhere else. Sometimes the reality we're living is painful, sometimes it's not desirable. And having access to the craft, any forms of art, and being able to express yourself in any form of art, you can just escape that place or take that place and transform it into whatever you want. And in this new world, new product or whatever you're creating, maybe it's just in your mind, you're gonna feel safe, because that's everything that you created there is something you know, because it came from you. So I think that's what art's most important for. It's not the product itself, it's what it creates for the artist. I feel like the people who go and see an artist in a stage, a musician, they can experience a little bit of that. But at the end of the day, they're going there to see, just see the artist, the singer, the dancer. And I'm talking about that because that's the art I do. They go there because they connect to that in a way. And somehow they didn't write that song, but that song does take them out of the reality they are and take them to a place that resonates to them, a place of comfort. And in those 1 hour of a show, 30 minutes, I don't know, the length of a song, that's them being saved. And that's the most magical thing. And I actually get very emotional about talking that. And when I told you I was finishing my PhD and I really, really missed being creative, it was that I missed creating those places where I could safely navigate into and stay, and everything there was enough. And that's what songwriting is for me. And that's what singing is for me. And in that space where I put myself, it's so much easier to connect to other people and to share and to communicate. It just really makes it so much easier because it withdraw myself from myself. It withdraw myself from my reality, from my background, from my traumas, from my cravings. And it's just really about that beautiful community. Yeah. So I'm very thankful for art. I don't think us humans could do life without it. And I do not understand people who do not appreciate it.
It's a really lovely example that you've shared with us today. Thank you for being so brave as well, for sharing all of those personal dramas that you've had to live through and the courage that you've shown to make the changes in your own life, and also for enabling such a fantastic piece of scientific work to reach all of us through the power of dance. I've learned so much. It's such great fun to discover the art of the kangaroo life through dance. It's been a real pleasure, Welly, talking to you today. I've really, really loved talking to you. And thank you so much for everything you've shared and for the example that you're setting.
Thank you so much, Paula. Really, really appreciate it. I also loved being here and speaking to you and your audience. Really, really appreciate it. If the audience wants to know more about Welly and the work, please go to my socials, subscribe, follow, whatever you want to do. The music's on Spotify. And if you want to reach out to me as well, having a conversation, please send me a message and I would love to hear your stories and know if this, everything I shared in my life resonates to you as well in any way. I really appreciate for the space, for the opportunity. I love doing podcasts. So I'm really thankful for this experience.
Wonderful. And I will make sure that your link is on your episode page so listeners can find you easily. And just in case there are scientists amongst you and you're interested in how this dance competition works, it's hosted by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thank you for listening.